Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Italian counterpart are hosting a meeting Sunday, seeking to show the support and commitment of the international community to a long-sought peace agreement in Libya. The country's rival governments are expected to sign the UN-brokered peace deal Wednesday after nearly a year of talks to agree on a process to create a unity government. The plan calls for the unity body to be formed within 40 days with members of both the current internationally recognized government based in Tobruk and the Islamist-backed body that has been operating out of Tripoli. Secretary Kerry and his counterpart are being joined Sunday by representatives from Libya's neighbors and others in the region. The U.S. government is urging its citizens to leave Burundi amid deadly clashes involving military and police. The State Department says it has ordered the departure of non-emergency U.S. officials and the families of personnel as political violence roils the country in the wake of contested elections and an attempted coup in May. The U.S. Embassy can only offer limited emergency services to U.S. citizens in Burundi, according to the State Department in a travel warning. Voters in the CAR, the Central African Republic, are casting ballots Sunday in a referendum on a new constitution. They seek an end to nearly 3 years of violence and division. The process was disrupted in several parts of the capital of Bangui, where there were reports of gunfire and small clashes between opponents and supporters of the referendum. The new constitution calls for the creation of a Senate, limiting future presidents to 2 terms in office. VOA News. The construction of a much-anticipated $10 billion pipeline transporting natural gas from Turkmenistan to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India began Sunday, 25 years after the inception of the project. The so-called Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India project aims to export up to 33 billion cubic meters of natural gas per year through the approximately 1,800-kilometer pipeline. The Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, the Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, and the Indian Vice President Hamid Ansari, together with the Turkmen President, attended the groundbreaking ceremony in the central city of Mary in Turkmenistan. This is the Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif.
This flagship project will usher in a new era and transform the lives of the millions of our people, making TAPI a symbol of shared prosperity and socio-economic development.
Observers have long termed the proposed project as a pipeline of regional peace, once completed, because it could go a long way in bringing arch rivals India and Pakistan closer and to promote stability in war-ravaged Afghanistan. Officials in northwestern Pakistan say a bomb blast ripped through a busy clothing market on Sunday, killing at least 23 people and wounding about 55 others. The explosion happened in Parchinar, that's the center of the semi-autonomous Kurram tribal district on the Afghan border. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for that blast. The political administrator for Kurram told the French news agency that the bomb had been hidden in a bag left at the market. French voters head to the polls Sunday for a second round of regional elections, with the far-right National Front Party hoping to take control of a region for the very first time. Marine Le Pen and her FN party would like to see a decisive second round that is as good as last week's round, in which the party came out on top in 6 of the 13 regions. Marine Le Pen spoke to reporters after casting her ballot. She says, I like democracy and don't like to see voters to be treated as children, to be terrorized, such as what several people have tried to do, the prime minister especially, in profoundly questionable conditions. Meanwhile, French President François Hollande's personal approval ratings have soared, with his hardline stance since the terrorist attacks, but his party's ratings remain low. At least 2 women have won municipal council seats in Saudi Arabia's first election open to women voters and candidates. Early results show Salma bin Hazab al-Tebi as the first confirmed victory for a woman running for a municipal council seat. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Most people who are going to be voting haven't actually seen it. Only 15,000 copies were printed and distributed around the country.
The Central African Republic votes in a constitutional referendum despite concerns of insecurity and logistical challenges.
The military, you know, who were in charge of the safety and security of Joe Biden himself and his convoy, they had no choice other than to defend themselves.
The Nigerian army chief survives a reported attack by an Islamic group.
The government, we're expecting, and the beneficiaries to contribute about $5 million, and another co-financier still to be identified. We are working around that, another $10 million.
And the Zimbabwean government and the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, sign a debt rescheduling agreement. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Central African Republic votes in a constitutional referendum Sunday amid concerns of insecurity and logistical challenges. The vote is seen as a key test ahead of much-delayed presidential and parliamentary polls. Parts of the country are still controlled by rebels who could disrupt voting. For VOA, Nick Long reports.
The United Nations mission in CAR, MINUSCA, has been scrambling to make Sunday's vote happen. MINUSCA Chief Parfait Onanga Anyanga said Friday that the mission had flown more than 60 flights and transported about 100 tons of electoral materials to all the country's 15 regional capitals in the past 48 hours. These preparations were held up by delays in producing the constitution that Central Africans are supposed to vote on. The CAR researcher for Human Rights Watch, Lewis Mudge, told VOA his office only received a copy of the 47-page document 2 days ago.
Most people who are going to be voting haven't actually seen it. Only 15,000 copies were printed and distributed around the country.
He added there's been too little attempt to explain the proposed changes.
There's been some outreach, but outreach on both the constitutional referendum and on the upcoming elections has been very poor by the national electoral authorities.
Voting could be disrupted in some parts of the country. Mudge said there's particular concern about the Nanagribezi area, one of the country's 15 prefectures, where armed group leader Nuruddin Adam, former number two of the mainly Muslim ex-Seleka group, has been saying the electoral process should not go ahead. Elsewhere, the ex-Seleka and mainly Christian anti-Balaka armed group could both intimidate voters. The referendum is likely to pass, allowing presidential elections to go ahead, says Mudge.
There is large consensus that the referendum will pass, mostly because the government has gone on a vote yes campaign. And, you know, if it does pass, then I think the vote's going to happen. Is it going to be successful? Depends on your definition of successful.
2 million voters have been registered, which is a record for the country. Still, with about 1 million of the 5 million population either in exile or displaced within the country, with only 35% of Muslim exiles who are eligible to vote actually registered, and with conflict continuing even in the capital, holding the referendum and the elections are big challenges. Nick Long for VOA News, Kinshasa.
The Nigerian Chief of Army Staff, Lieutenant General Tukur Yusuf Buratai's convoy was attacked by members of an Islamic group loyal to Sheikh Ibrahim el-Zakzaki in the northern city of Zaria on Saturday. Military spokesman Colonel Sani Kukashika Osman says the soldiers in charge of protecting the army chief thwarted the attack. But the Islamic group denied firing and stopping the convoy of the army chief moving through the area. They accused the army of a cover-up in an ongoing attempt to crush Zakzaki and his movement. Colonel Osman told me that the Islamic group is to blame for the attack.
It is quite true in the sense that yesterday afternoon, when the convoy of the chief of army staff coming from Douze Ejigao State, you know, we had a 1 week annual conference of the chief of army staff at that city. And on his way to pay homage to the emir of Zazo, and subsequently review the passing out parade of the 73 regular recruits intake of Depot Nigerian Army Zaria, a group of youth, along Husseiniyah Bakia, which is the headquarters of the Shiite sect in Zaria, barricaded the roads, burning tires, forming bonfire with dangerous weapon, insisting that the chief of army staff will not pass. Not only him, any other person. It was made abundantly clear who he was and what was his mission, but they remained adamant. They refused. Rather, they found out, took up positions with dangerous weapons. And unfortunately, there was loud bang and explosion. The military, who were in charge of the safety and security of Joe Biden himself and his convoy, they had no choice other than to defend themselves and open the road for law-abiding citizens to pass.
Now,
the Joe Biden himself escaped unhurt.
Colonel Usman, the group said that it is not true that an attempt was made on the chief of army's life and that the army's attack was well too planned and that the army is using this as a pretext to crush the group, which they say consists of law-abiding citizens in that part of the country.
That assertion is not correct. Personally, I was there. The records are there. The good thing is that we always move along with the journalists who are the witness to all this, and they recorded everything. And apart from that, there are other witnesses too.
The group said three of the sons of the leader of the group, Sheikh Ibrahim El Zakzaki, have been targeted in the past, and yesterday's incident is an indication that the army is selectively crushing Islamic groups in the country. What is your reaction to that?
There is no plan whatsoever. Nobody had ever thought about that. Believe me, sincerely speaking, the incident could have been avoided had it been that they did not barricade that road, they did not make an attempt on the life of the chief of army staff, brandishing weapons, coming out with dang guns and other dangerous weapons. It is there. They knew abundantly, it was made abundantly clear to them that, look, this was the chief of army staff. Whatever problem, whatever grievances they have, now he is here. Allow him pass it so that we can, settle down and discuss this issue and negotiate it further. But they refused. And even all efforts to make sure that their leader comes out so that he would prevail on them, rather the situation kept on aggravating, finding out and cycling, the convoy of the chief of army staff. And you need to be at that environment to know, from the bike here down to the polo club, down to railway clinic.
The accusation of the Islamic group is that the army want to execute its leader, Sheikh Ibrahim El Zakzaki, and they insist that the Islamic movement has mass support across Nigeria and is renowned as a peaceful group that has never been implicated in any violence and that it strongly opposes Boko Haram. What is your reaction to the statement that the army plans to execute the leader?
There is no such plan. The Nigerian army is a professional military force that is law-abiding, that is guided by the rules and rules of engagement and the principles of rule of law. We are established by the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. There has never been a time where the army acted unilaterally to harm or antagonize a law-abiding innocent citizen of the country. They perpetrated a crime, and now it's suddenly down on them that what they did was wrong. And in any case, yesterday, they told three divergent stories. First and foremost, they made allegations that their members were killed in faraway Bagari, and that is why they will not allow anybody exit or entry. Suddenly, they said, They were going to bury some people. Then suddenly, their leader came out with the story again that they were raising a flag, and as such, everybody has to stand still. This is Federal Republic of Nigeria. There is no flag that is far more sacred than the flag, the national flag of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. You cannot deprive any law-abiding citizen of the country freedom of association, freedom of movement. But every now and then they do that, and it is always violent. The records are there. They had weapons.
Colonel Sani Kukashuka Usman is the Nigerian military spokesman. He spoke with me from Kaduna in northern Nigeria. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi recently met with the heads of state of more than 50 African countries to discuss ways to improve the continent's health infrastructure. The talks also focus on extending the reach of India's lucrative generic drug industry into Africa, where the need for low-cost medications is great. Viewer's Jessica Berman has more.
Developing countries in Africa are battling a host of deadly infectious diseases, from diarrheal conditions to malaria to HIV. Most low-cost generic antiretroviral drugs to treat HIV have come from India. India's drug industry, which has become the world's leader in the manufacture and export of generic drugs, could fill the need for drugs for other conditions as well. The drugs cost a fraction of the originals. Exports have reaped $15 billion for the Indian economy by some estimates. But inspectors have identified factories that produce substandard drugs that are dangerous, either because they contain toxic ingredients or simply do not work. Health economist Roger Bate is with the American Enterprise Institute, a Washington-based research organization. Fake malaria drugs have already made it to Africa, and Bate worries that more copycat drugs could be on the way.
India seems to segment its markets. It sends, on average, it sends the better quality medicines to richer countries like the U.S., and the medicines that don't pass quality control, it sends to poorer nations, particularly those in Africa.
Global health consultant Gaurav Nayar confirms that poorly made and counterfeit drugs are being exported to poorer countries. Nayar says she's visited some of the sham factories, but she says knowing about the problem and doing something about it are two different things.
You can see that there's children in the market buying this counterfeit product, taking it and dying, and that's actually what inspired me to work on the problem. But it's how do you translate that into policy and action that we can actually fix it? And that's where I think this entire engine is stuck.
Nayar says samples of drugs that have made it to market have been tested for purity and effectiveness, but she says tracing bad drugs back to the source can be extremely difficult. Most generics do what they're supposed to do, and countries that import them do not want to harm anyone. But Bate says health officials in poorer nations face a dilemma.
You know, the immediate response of anyone taking the drugs is horror at that kind of, you know, a position, because they'll say, surely you should just boycott the product. The reality is that it's very difficult to do that because you end up with significant shortages.
For their part, experts say countries in Africa are also interested in getting into the business of manufacturing generic drugs, both as a way to boost their economies and get life-saving medications to their people. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The leader of the South Sudanese opposition SPLM-IO says he is disappointed with the actions of President Salva Kiir's administration. Dr. Riek Machar says the implementation of the peace agreement depends on the presence of his advance team in the capital, Juba. Machar told South Sudan in Focus's John Tanza that the international community must put pressure on the government in Juba to implement the peace agreement.
We are responding again to the government to allow our advance team to go. We have 7 points which we think we would work together with the government. One, the speedy dissemination of the peace among various communities in the country is one objective. The other objective is to ensure that the reconciliation process is kicked off very speedily by our advance team. The third is that we want the process of confidence building among our membership and the government party to be also tackled. Fourth, we want to encourage the IDPs that are in the UN camps to want to encourage to go to back to their houses and villages.
The government in Juba is saying that your number is too big, and they are saying if you can reduce them, they will appreciate. You are saying you want to send this big number because they are supposed to do the things that you are listing. Now, this is going to take long time before the two of you agree on the number of the advance team. In the meantime, if there's going to be no progress, what is plan B?
The government is not paying for the transport of our advance team. Second, the government is not paying for the accommodation in Juba. Third, the government is not paying for the transport of the state advance teams. They're not. It costs them nothing at all. So their objection on security grounds is baseless. After all, they're not armed. Most of them are political activists, members of parliament, either the national, legislative, or the council of state. We see no reason why they should create a fuss out of it.
This number you're talking about is 600 plus. How are you taking care of these people in Pagak?
I tell you, it's very difficult, huh? We are more than that because we had a conference, a peace implementation conference, and the people are waiting. Some will go back to where they came from, but the advance team is stuck with me here. Feeding them is not an easy task.
South Sudanese people at this moment, with all the economic hardship in Juba and all over the country, are really waiting to hear a definite answer from the leadership of the country about when will this peace agreement be implemented. If you're given an opportunity to assure them, what would you tell them?
The implementation of the peace agreement starts with the advance team. Once our advance team arrives Juba, and in actual fact, they join the JMAC, which is the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission. Our members will be in that advance team. Our members also in the CTSAM, that is Ceasefire Transitional Security Monitoring Mechanism, our three members will be there. And then the JMCC, the Joint Military Ceasefire Commission, our members will also be in that team. And then the National Constitutional Amendment Committee, our members are also in that. So the institutions for implementation of the peace agreement, the members will be in the advance team. So the process of implementing the peace agreement would be kicked off very speedily with the arrival of our advanced team.
That's Dr. Riek Machar, leader of the South Sudanese opposition, SPLM-IO. He spoke with South Sudan in Focus's John Tanza from his headquarters in Pagak, Upper Nile State. Zimbabwe and the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, have signed a debt rescheduling agreement that will result in IFAD resuming financial support to Zimbabwe. IFAD will initially provide $55 million under the country's Smallholder Irrigation Revitalization Program next year. For VOA, Ivan Chifera reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
IFAD Regional Director for East and Southern Africa, San Jata, who was in Harare to sign the deal, said the organization, which suspended projects in Zimbabwe over 23 million arrears, was re-engaging it in a new deal that has seen Zimbabwe pay 10% of the arrears and made an undertaking to pay the remainder over a five-year period. He said the program to be funded by IFAD will rehabilitate and develop new smallholder irrigation schemes covering 8,000 hectares and benefiting more than 20,000 households.
The government, we are expecting, and the beneficiaries to contribute about $5 million, and another co-financier still to be identified. We are working around that, another $10 million.
He said IFAD will provide more financial resources if Zimbabwe does not fall into arrears again. Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa said, due to climate change, government efforts to develop agriculture must focus on irrigation.
We have no choice. This is now out of necessity, and we should plow and deploy more resources in this sector. So the assistance that we are going to get, the resources that we are expecting to obtain from IFAD, will be a major shot in the arm of the agricultural sector in this country, especially irrigation development.
Deputy Agriculture and Mechanization Minister Paddy Shanda said the agricultural sector continues to face many challenges, such as lack of adequate inputs and climate change. He said resources from IFAD should be used to address these issues and ensure food security, especially in rural areas.
The program will sustainably increase diversification of production, productivity and household incomes for smallholder farmers. This support is aligned to the food and nutrition cluster, the ZIM asset economic blueprint, and the 10-point plan for economic growth, whose fundamental pillar is the revitalization of the agriculture sector and the agro-processing value chain.
Tirarami Muyambo, an agricultural extension officer with a local non-governmental organization, said while he was not aware of the details of the IFAD program, irrigation was the best way to go, especially for the country's natural regions 4 and 5.
Issues of irrigation are critical in this country because you know that due to climate change, areas in Region 5, in Chipinge, where I have so much knowledge on, I have been experiencing drought almost year in, year out. So it's a welcome development. I think it will change and help in rebuilding the redeveloping food security in Zimbabwe.
The IFAD program will have four components, namely rehabilitation and development of irrigation infrastructure, agricultural credit, institutional strengthening, and market access and business development. Government in the meantime is expected to establish a unit that would coordinate the implementation of the program. Chinamasa said the gesture by IFAD was an indication that the government's re-engagement effort with the international community was paying off, and government would do all it can to achieve full admission into the community of nations. Zimbabwe requires long-term financing to reboot its economy, but is constrained by external debts which have blocked the flow of international capital into the country. IFAD has been operating in Zimbabwe since 1980 and cancelled its support to the country in 2006 after it defaulted on its arrears. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis recently took his message of religious tolerance to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss interfaith solutions to combat religious intolerance and extremism. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information. ¶¶
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, right here in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy. See this loving way I get, he gonna take away your sorrow. See this loving way I get, he gonna day until tomorrow. See this loving way I get, take the lead and I will follow. Baby, always, always,
Mastercraft on the beat.
Mega.
dangerous. The way you do, girl, you are dangerous. Anytime I see you move it, girl, you are dangerous. Baby girl, you are dangerous. Everybody now, oh my God, tell me your mind, oh no, 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 we want to make you mine, oh yeah. Baby girl, you come up me from mine, oh. Take me down to major, the way you handle that. Uku, laga, 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 hey, uku, ade, ade, laga, uku, 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 ade.
Yeah. Yeah. Palanga, I'm your demon. Mix Mosa, Mix Mosa.
Some of them never know me. Some of them don't know me. Some of them keep for me. Every time the people don't sing, some of them wanna whine for me. Some of them boogie down for me. We love the way the ladies will whine for me. Everybody now, like a hey. Everybody go. Hey. I like the way you do it. Hey.
Plenty, plenty. Chop money. Hey, it's good to be saving for rainy days.
Not so.
Cause you know easy, eh? Life is so delicate. Oh, oh. So make una see me as evidence. Baba God, now my confidence.
Yes.
His blessings are endless. So,
oh.
As if he said, I don't go. Oh. Some people, they bubble. Oh.
Hey.
I continue the struggle. Oh. The struggle, they double my hustle. Oh.
Hey.
As if he said, I don't go. Some people they bubble, oh.
Yeah.
I continue the struggle, oh. They double my hustle, yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony,
oh.
I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat, oh.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. China is on the march in Africa.
concerted efforts in some segment of the global media to convince Africa that China has embarked on a neo-colonialism of Africa has failed. It is possible that some Africans have believed that myth, but we must not forget what colonialism was in Africa. European powers had come into that continent, sometimes with some gifts, some arms, small arms, and they have hoodwinked the leaders of Africa, and it is by that means that they occupied almost all of the continents. Colonialism is also a fact that at the Berlin Conference, European powers sat together with a map without any African presence and partitioned Africa for their colonial rule. China has done nothing of the sort. China has tried since the victory of the Communist Party in China to relate with Africa. And the Chinese have never forgotten the role that Africa played in its gaining of its rightful place in the United Nations in 1971. China has also emerged as a major economic power. And despite resistance by the International Monetary Fund, IMF, last week the IMF succumbed and agreed to make the Chinese currency renminbi as one of the reserve currency for special drawing rights. This is a major, major victory for China in terms of its economy and finance. It will facilitate its dealing with many countries, particularly in Africa. Shortly after that news was announced by the IMF, the president of China, Xi, visited the major country in Africa, Zimbabwe, whose leader has found himself in great hot water with European countries. And after the meeting in Zimbabwe, Xi proceeded to Pretoria in South Africa for the China-African Summit. That summit advanced China's relationship with Africa in the economic and financial sense, and one can say that relationship, which goes back into Bandung in 1955 until the present, has now matured. In the speech by President Xi, he gave a 10-point plan, and that 10-point plan came to a figure of $60 billion credit line that will deal with a whole array of economic matters dealing with infrastructure, with economic assistance, with loan grants. And this will be the basis of the further development in the relationship between China and Africa. Now, it ups to the African countries themselves to see how best they can go forward with this relationship. But there will be attempts, as in the past, to warn some Africans, and some of them may fall into the trap. But what Africans must see is the genuine help of Africa, the continent which is in the field of poverty. China has given the way, and hopefully Africa will learn from China on how it managed to develop its economy and to lift its people out of poverty. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Jiang Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the little opportunity given to a monkey to wear clothes does not guarantee it to join the dining. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As the Helsinki Final Act marks its 40th anniversary, it is critical that all members of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe remain faithful to its core principles. These principles include recognizing the inherent dignity and human rights of every person, respecting the sovereignty and territorial integrity of every participating state, and refraining from the threat or use of force across the OSCE region. In light of these commitments, the United States renews its call for Russia and the separatists that it backs to fully implement the Minsk agreements to which Moscow is a signatory. This includes the removal of Russian forces and equipment from eastern Ukraine and unfettered access for OSCE monitors. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has emphasized the importance of the Minsk agreement's provision for local elections in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine to be carried out under Ukrainian law and subject to monitoring by the OSCE Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. There must also be a return to Ukrainian control of the border and the release of all hostages detained for politically motivated reasons. Meanwhile, Ukraine needs to do its part by withdrawing its heavy weapons and to negotiate in good faith the Donbas election procedures. This is a time for concrete steps, said Secretary Kerry at the recent OSCE ministerial meeting in Serbia, and to avoid what is a disastrous but unnecessary conflict, and to begin the process of rebuilding Ukraine's east. Elsewhere in the OSCE, protracted conflicts continue in places like Moldova's breakaway region of Transnistria, Georgia, and Nagorno-Karabakh. The protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms throughout the OSCE region continues to be a priority. In too many countries, said Secretary Kerry, non-governmental organizations are being restricted by new laws. Journalism is under attack and the freedom of expression, including the media, is in jeopardy, sometimes by threat of force. There is no acceptable excuse for abusing the rights of citizens, for preventing journalists from doing their jobs, or from silencing legitimate political dissent. I hope that we will all reaffirm these fundamental ideals, said Secretary Kerry. The enduring promise of Helsinki should inspire all of us to tackle these shared challenges with renewed urgency and to continue our efforts in building a Europe and a Eurasia that is whole and free and at peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.